Chechnya's Russian forces are reportedly getting closer to the Ukrainian capital, with the city's mayor saying Kiev has been transformed into a fortress. Iran's foreign minister says a good and durable agreement on the revival of the JCPOA is within reach if the U.S. acts realistically and consistently. The U.S. says North Korea has recently used intercontinental ballistic missiles in two secretive launches, calling it a serious escalation. Welcome to the program. Key battleground developments on day 16 of the Russian offensive in Ukraine. Russia says it has launched a high-precision, long-range attack on two military airfields in the city of Lutsk and Ivano-Frankivsk. Moscow says the airfields are now out of action. It says Russian forces have destroyed over 3,200 Ukrainian military installations since the beginning of the offensive. Russian troops are now edging closer to the capital, Kiev. The city's mayor says half of the population has fled, with Kiev being transformed into, quote, a fortress. At least four major Ukrainian cities are encircled by Russian forces. They include Kharkiv in the east and Sumy in the northeast. In the meantime, pro-Russian forces fighting for independence for years say they have captured Volnovakha. It's located north of the besieged city of Mariupol. Ukraine has accused Russia of bombing corridors that were open to evacuate civilians. Our correspondent Robert Carter joined us earlier to talk about the influx of Ukrainian refugees that have been fleeing to Poland. He says the country has received the largest share of refugees and will be facing a huge battle to shelter these people.
Well over a million people are now inside, are inside Poland right now. So it's a huge uphill battle that Poland is facing to try and cater for all of these new guests. In fact, I have a statistic which suggests, it was published by the Wall Street Journal today, that up to two Ukrainian refugees are entering Poland every 3 seconds right now. So that's just how serious the situation is. Obviously, Poland is a country which traditionally doesn't like to take in refugees, as we've seen from their handling of African or Middle Eastern refugees in past crises. They prefer to keep them out. But on this occasion, they've opened their doors and they're now trying to handle this influx of mass people, this mass movement that has occurred. So obviously, the situation here, Poland is facing its own battle with the refugee situation. But the situation inside Ukraine is intensifying, and obviously reports are coming in thick and fast of continued fighting and bomb attacks and things like that. And obviously the capital, Kiev, is a very, it's a hot spot for that violence. And the more the violence inside Ukraine escalates, more refugees from other parts of the country start to look to leave. And of course, the majority of them are heading to Poland.
Tensions between the U.S. and Russia over Ukraine take on new aspects, with the two sides now locked in a dispute over alleged biolabs in Ukraine. Russia has accused the U.S. of financing a Ukrainian biological program involving deadly pathogens for military purposes. Washington denies that, calling the accusation gaslighting. The U.S. says the Russian claim is in line with its false flag efforts that Washington has warned before. The government in Kiev has also denied any such program on Ukrainian soil. Now, the U.N. Security Council is set to convene later on Friday to discuss the issue. The meeting will be held at the request of Russia. European Union leaders dismiss Ukraine's appeal for rapid accession to the bloc.
There is a request for a candidate membership from Ukraine, and that is now in process, and we have fast-tracked the sending it on to the Commission earlier this week by the Council. That's one, but that will take time, months, maybe years before you get to anything.
Except Eastern Germany in times of Helmut Kohl, nobody entered the European Union overnight.
Ukraine applied for the fast EU membership shortly after Russia began its military operation there on February 24th. Ukraine's neighbors on the EU's eastern flank back Kiev's rapid accession, but others, like the Netherlands, say for now what is important is that Ukraine has made the demand. On Thursday, EU leaders met in France to discuss further support to Ukraine in the face of the ongoing Russian offensive. They also discussed how to reduce their reliance on Russian energy. Already high fuel prices have soared in Europe in recent days in the wake of sanctions on Russian energy. The heads of the European Union have met in the suburbs of the French capital to discuss the ongoing crisis between Russia and Ukraine. In response to the crisis, Europe is considering sweeping changes which could create historic impacts, specifically on the continent's energy sector. Ramin Mazahiri has more.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as two-thirds of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the two-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe. So Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Negotiations to revive the 2015 landmark Iran deal are underway in Austria's capital. Now, Iran's foreign minister says a good and durable agreement is within reach if the United States acts realistically and consistently. In a tweet, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said no single party can determine the end result of the negotiations. He said a joint endeavor is needed to accomplish the Vienna talks. Earlier, the top diplomat rejected what he called U.S. excessive demands, saying they do not have a logical justification. The eighth round of negotiations are now underway in Vienna. Iran says a deal is possible if the West makes necessary decisions, verifiable removal of sanctions, and guarantees that the U.S. does not leave the agreement are Iran's key demands. It says the deal will be possible if everything is not, or will not be possible, I should say, if everything is not agreed upon. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018, as you may know, and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Sayed Mohsen Abbas says Iran's long history of resistance against U.S. sanctions enables it to withstand Washington's excessive demands during the Vienna talks.
But Iran is still being pretty magnanimous in these negotiations, in spite of seeing the American ship sinking very, very steadily before our very eyes. And with the economic collapse coming, you don't know what else is going to happen in terms of the Western situation around their own economic status. Iran is not going to be affected. Iran has been suffering from economic sanctions for decades. They've gone through the most abysmal and abhorrent sanctions. Now, that's one of the issues that is going to be a real sticking point within the negotiations. And I'm sure this is the one which the Americans are trying somehow to get out of. And that is, they want to lift any sanctions. But, of course, Iran is going to be demanding that not only are they lifted, but there are guarantees and there is a clear-cut route for the cancellation of those quite abhorrently sanctioned.
Iran has launched futures contracts at its energy exchange market. As Iran has the world's largest oil and gas reserves, the launch of futures can turn the country into a pricing reference for its crude oil and natural gas in the region. Salman Khojouri has more.
Iran has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Iran's energy exchange on futures platform, Iran's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while they are also some strong hedging tools. They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Salman Khojouri, Tehran.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un orders the expansion and modernizing of a satellite launching station on the northwest coast. North Korean media say the order aims to ensure that various rockets could be launched to carry out, or to carry, that is, multi-purpose satellites, including a military reconnaissance one. In the meantime, neighboring South Korea and its ally, the United States, say the North recently used intercontinental ballistic missiles in two secretive launches. Seoul and Washington say the ICBM system used in these tests could be the largest ever Pyongyang has. The U.S. says the tests are a serious escalation that requires a united global response. Japan says it's considering more sanctions against North Korea. Pyongyang, mind you, is already under crippling international sanctions over its missile and nuclear weapons programs. March 11 marks the 10th anniversary of Kandahar massacre, on which a U.S. Army sergeant, murdered 16 Afghan civilians and wounded six others, including children, in eastern Afghanistan. 10 years on, Afghanistan's public opinion is still seeking justice for the massacre.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gilani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, nightraids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And the U.S. consumer prices hit a new 40-year high amid rising inflation in the world's largest economy. Labor Department says consumer price index was at nearly 8% in February compared to the same month last year. That's the biggest jump since January 1982. The rise comes as gasoline, food, and housing prices have skyrocketed. The Federal Reserve is set to increase interest rates to deal with the rising inflation. It is expected that the fallout from Russia's military action in Ukraine will exacerbate the crisis. Financial experts warn of another shock as a result of the West's anti-Moscow sanctions. Russia is a major producer of oil and natural gas, as well as food commodities. That's it for me for now. Thank you.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we completed the explanation of Surah Najm, and from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Qamar, which is number 54 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 55 ayahs. It opens with cataclysmic sign of the end of the world coming and the moon having split apart. It takes its name from the opening ayah, which mentions the moon or Qamar, that here serves as a reference to the Day of Resurrection. The surah deals mainly with the punishment dealt out to the previous generations of disbelievers. These were presented as a warning to the pagans of Mecca, and are also relevant to the disbelievers of all times. With the refrain, is there anyone who will be admonished, running throughout the surah. Finally, the treatment of the disbelievers on the Day of Judgment is contrasted to the everlasting bliss the believers will enjoy in paradise. An interesting feature of this surah is that all 55 of its ayahs end with the letter R. A narration from the Prophet of Islam says, whoever recites Surah Qamar and perseveres will enter the plane of judgment in a splendor on the Day of Resurrection on condition of having acted upon Quranic injunctions. Let us start with ayah 1, 2, and 3 of Surah Qamar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. اقتربت الساعة وانشق القمر وإن يروا آية يعرضوا ويقولوا سحر مستمر وكذبوا واتبعوا أهواءهم وكل أمر مستقر.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. The hour has drawn near and the moon is split. If they see a sign, they turn away and say, an incessant magic. They denied and followed their own desires, and every matter has a setting appropriate to it. The opening ayah, which mentions the drawing near of the hour, is a reference to the inevitability of the Day of Resurrection as the most significant alteration in the world of creation that after death and revival opens a new life in the hereafter. It is a realm whose greatness and extent are indescribable and unintelligible to us, because of attachment to the materialistic world. In other words, resurrection is close to us. It is a constant reminder that life of the mortal world is transient, which means we ought to be attentive and prepare for the provision of the hereafter. The opening ayah ends with the Arabic words, Shaqul Qamar, or splitting of the moon, which is a reference to a famous miracle of the Prophet of Islam, recorded in several eyewitness accounts, and is an undeniable proof of divine omnipotence over all things. It was performed at the insistent demand of the Arab pagans and the Jews. At night, the Prophet performed prayer and prostration to God and supplicated, at which, to the amazement of the onlookers, the full moon was cleft asunder. The Jews who had read in the Torah how God made the sun and the moon stand still for Prophet Joshua, the successor of Prophet Moses, peace upon them, accepted the truth of Islam on seeing this miracle, but Abu Jahl, the leader of the pagan Arabs of Mecca, refused to believe and called it magic, as Ayah 2 says, "If they see a sign, they turn away and say, an incessant magic." The splitting of the moon was not any deception of the eyesight of the onlookers in Mecca, since this phenomenon was witnessed by travelers to Syria and was also visible in far-off India, as testified by inscriptions on monuments in Kerala, where King Chakravarti Perumal of the Malabar region, seeing this strange sight, and later on learning that the last prophet had appeared in the Arabian Peninsula, made a journey to Mecca and became a Muslim. A scientific proof of this miracle is the deep scar or rift discovered on the moon and photographed by NASA astronomers in the US, which is further proof of such a phenomenon occurring in the past. According to exegetes, when resurrection draws near, the moon will also cleft asunder. As is clear by Ayah 3, it is the habit of obdurate disbelievers to belie the truth of the prophetic call, of miracles, and of the inevitability of resurrection, because they follow their concupiscent desires, without realizing that everyone receives the reward and recompense of their own deeds, since nothing shall be effaced in this world. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the day of resurrection will certainly occur no matter the disbelievers deny the truth, including the universal mission of the seal of messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Number two, the miracles are not a matter of surprise, since everything, including the wonders of nature, is in the power of the Almighty Creator, who granted the Prophet of Islam several miracles, of which the greatest and the eternal is the Noble Quran, whose flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom no one has been able to match. And number three, obstinate persons call miracles a magic and deny the manifest truth because of their immersion in carnal desires. Now let us listen to ayahs 4 and 5 of the same surah.
وَلَقَدْ جَاءَهُمْ مِنَ الْأَنْبَاءِ مَا فِيهِ مُزْدَجَرُ حِكْمَةٌ بَالِغَةٌ فَمَا تُغْنِ النُّذُرُ.
There have already come to them, the disbelievers, reports containing admonishment and representing far-reaching wisdom, but warnings are of no avail. The account of the ancients and the divine wrath that struck them for their abominable sins and unpardonable crimes against humanity are mentioned in the Noble Quran as admonishment for all in order to desist from the falsehood. But the intransigent disbelievers never heed these far-reaching or profound words of wisdom. In other words, the fate that befell the past nations ought to open our eyes, since the apparent triumph of tyranny and evil is short-lived, and it is truth that eventually triumphs. There is inevitable reckoning on the Day of Judgment. Ayah 5 points out that the Noble Quran is wisdom par excellence. The opponents of truth are aware of the fate of the misled nations of the past. Yet they continue their evil deeds and denial of facts and realities, thereby bringing destruction upon themselves, despite the long respite the All-Merciful God has given for repentance and reform. The ayahs of the Noble Quran, which are for all time and all places, thus seal the argumentation so that people hear the truth, ponder upon it, and decide to take the course of action. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, reflection on the history and fate of the nations of the past help us discover the truth and the causes of destruction of the ancient civilizations. Number two, the message of the Noble Quran is based on wisdom and logic. And number three, prophets proclaim the truth in order to seal the argumentation for mankind, since facts cannot be forced upon anyone and there is no compulsion in their acceptance, as the Almighty has given us the intellect to discern between good and evil, which eventually determines reward or punishment. In conclusion of this week's episode, let us listen to ayahs 6, 7, and 8 of Surah Qamar.
فَتَوَلَّ عَنْهُمْ يَوْمَ يَدْعُ الدَّاعِ إِلَى شَيْءٍ نُكُرٍ خُشَّ عَنْ أَبْصَارُهُمْ يَخْرُجُونَ مِنَ الْأَجْدَاثِ كَأَنَّهُمْ جَرَادٌ مُنْتَشِرٌ مهطعين إلى الداعي يقول الكافرون هذا يوم عسير.
So turn away from them, the day when the caller calls for a dire thing. With a humbled look in their eyes, they will emerge from their graves as if they were a scattered locust scrambling toward the summoner. The faithless will say, "This is a hard day." Ayah 6 addresses the Prophet of Islam and means to say that when disbelievers refuse to believe even after witnessing such great miracles, you leave them to their fate without taking more trouble in the hope of removing their ignorance, but convey the message that when the day the divine caller calls people towards a horrible thing, that is the resurrection for the final judgment on the basis of the record of everyone's deeds, they will have no clue to what awaits them. As the next ayah means to say, the humbling eyes is a token of intensity of fear or shamefulness of the disbelievers and sinners. The similitude of disbelievers and sinners on the day of resurrection to scattered locusts reflects their perplexity and astonishment upon coming out of graves and hastening hither and thither and witnessing the torment on that day. In other words, when they leave their graves upon the call, they protrude their necks toward the calling angels out of the intensity of fear. It is but natural that when a horrible sound is heard, people immediately protrude their neck and then turn toward its source, hasten toward it, and have no other choice but to make their presence at the divine tribunal. As Ayah 8 means to say, the horror of the hard incidents of that day encompasses them all, since all the things cause fear in sinners. May God Almighty bestow His mercy upon His servants. On that day, there shall be neither fear nor grief for the believers. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, unsealing the argumentation, the faithless should be left to their own fate, to accept the truth or to deny it, since God has given the freedom to choose a reward or punishment. Number two, the sins of the day of resurrection are extremely horrible for the faithless and the sinners. Unimaginable consequences indeed. And number three, resurrection is physical and all mankind will be brought to life in their original shape for the final judgment.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Kavitat Wade. There are no ambiguities about how the avalanche of sanctions against Russia is destroying the Russian economy. But what about the economy of European countries, or the U.S. for that matter? How about the rest of the world? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether the economic warfare against Russia will make or break Russia first, or Europe and the U.S. perhaps, a gamble with the economic brunt ultimately falling on the ordinary people.
Since Russia attacked Ukraine on February 24th, Western countries have resorted to a host of restrictive economic measures to hinder Russia's ability to finance its military offensive in Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe, in particular, have imposed what they call unprecedented sanctions on Russia. They have frozen the assets of Russia's central bank, limiting its ability to access $630 billion of reserves. Likewise, planned investments in Russia have been restricted as a result of imposing capital controls. Moreover, several Russian banks have been removed from the SWIFT payment system to further isolate the country from the global financial system.
The sanctions has been triggered by the war, and the purpose is to weaken the Russian economy.
The sanctions have led to a sharp devaluation of the Russian currency, the ruble, and pushing up the inflation. The crushing ruble is creating growing panic among Russian citizens and increasing the inflation. Europe is under pressure to broaden sanctions by targeting Russia's energy sector, but the continent imports about 25% of its oil and 40% of its gas from Russia, and the huge energy reliance has turned out to be a stumbling block. Gas prices in Europe soared to record highs on Monday, on supply fears, reaching over $3,900 per 1,000 cubic meters for the first time in history. Sanctions on Russia are expected to further increase oil and gas prices, which will fuel inflation and intensify an already acute squeeze on living standards in Europe. Ending the war in Ukraine through pressurizing Putin is a priority for European leaders, but for now, they are weighing up how much pain they are prepared to inflict on their own people. Russia's economy is integrated into the global economy, and that means sanctions will hurt not only Russia, but the countries that impose such penalties. Sanctions are generally meant to bring about a policy shift or a change of leadership, but experience shows they fail to achieve those goals, despite bringing a lot of pain to the civilian populations. Whether Russia's efforts in the past years to make its economy sanctions-proof will pay off, or how the country will survive the tough sanctions regime it's facing, is anyone's guess. But the main question is if the Western countries are prepared to go all the way and sanction Russian energy exports altogether.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is John Ross. He's a senior fellow at the Chung-Yang Institute for Financial Studies, who joins us from London. Also joining us, Paolo Raffone, Secretary General of the SIPPI Foundation, who joins us from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Ross, I'm going to start with you. It must have looked very simple in some ways for the Russian President Vladimir Putin to have executed this military operation, given the military superiority of Russia and the Kremlin perhaps thinking that this operation is going to take a limited number of days, perhaps, or a short period of time. But at this point, we're looking at a gamble that Russia was hoping that if the duration was going to take a little bit long, that it could draw upon its war chest of about $630 billion. We can see that that has not transpired. Do you think that the Russian strategy in terms of its support is something that was either underestimated or not thoroughly thought through by the Russian president?
No, I think that the estimate of the situation of Russia is very simple. Russia was facing a deadly threat to itself. The incorporation of Ukraine into NATO would place NATO missiles, including nuclear missiles, about 5 minutes flying time from Moscow. And Russia made clear it was not prepared to accept this under any circumstances, in exactly the same way that the US in the Cuban Missile Crisis was prepared, if necessary, to go to nuclear war in order to prevent there being Soviet missiles within a few minutes flying time to Washington. That was the position of the Russia in this situation, the same as the US, and it struck against that. Then people totally misunderstand the history of Russia. Russia has been attacked four times. This is the fourth attack on Russia in the last two centuries from the West, but from Napoleon in 1812, the Whites in 1918, the Hitler in 1941, and each time Russia has defended itself and defeated the people who attack it. If you think it's going to be put off by the fact that Russian banks are taken out of SWIFT, or the Russian people are not capable of suffering that, they completely misunderstand Russian history.
Okay, we need to... But the history is not, Paolo Raffone, what is transpiring right now, today, looking at the different tools that Russia has in terms of trying to sustain sanctions. I talked about the war chest. I'd like to find out from you how Russia is estimating or forecasting at this point, from this point forward, how it's going to be able to maintain its military operation. Obviously, the sanction onslaught, which we're going to get into, is so severe. One of the consequences has been Russia's accessibility to its funds, which at this point, at least $460 billion worth, it can't access. No, this is for Paolo Raffone. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paolo Raffone.
Yeah, evidently these the sanctions are unprecedented, also because they are targeting the central bank, which is one of the key organs of the identity of the state. So they are really unprecedented. So far, these kind of actions called sanctions were targeting commercial interests or individuals specifically. This time they have been a leap forward. I do not see much of a problem for Russia because finally the reserves that Russia has, also in terms of gold and other assets, are sufficient to sustain the needs of Russia, even in the military endeavor that is carrying out. Mm-hmm. So there will be some problems, as we already know. There are some problems in the adjustment from an open world to a closed world, but they will keep going.
All right. Well, let's keep going and look at the broader world and look at the impacts that this has had, John Ross. The price of oil, it hit $140 a barrel. I mean, these are prices we haven't seen since the year 2008. We're looking at countries that are suffering from it, really, worldwide. But in particular, in this case in point, we could talk about the U.S., or you could talk about the U.S. and also Europe, in terms of how it's impacting those economies. And we talked a little bit about the Russian perspective, but is this something that you think the Europeans and the U.S., which in some ways are leading, perhaps, this whole sanctions, did think that through? Was it in their calculations that oil would get to this price? And then, what about a strategy for substituting it, which, again, we'll talk a little later as to some of the different routes they have taken?
No, I think they probably didn't calculate it would go to this price. I mean, I think it's destroyed the Biden presidency. I mean, he's already got inflation problems in the United States, and with the price of oil, I think he's finished. And therefore, the aggressive policy which the United States has carried out against Russia, because that's what's involved. The situation was totally clear. Russia was perfectly prepared to accept for Ukraine to be neutral. It was not prepared to accept for Ukraine to be part of NATO. Biden insisted on going ahead with the policy of NATO. He's now produced a war. He's produced a gigantic oil price. And he will lose the presidency as a result of this. So he's done himself in. Similarly, prospects will unroll themselves in Europe. But in the United States, it's totally clear that Biden has committed suicide by this aggression.
Some say, according to some polls, one poll, that Biden's presidency is going to be defined by this Ukraine war. Well, John Ross, Paolo Raffone, the U.S. Is suffering from economic fallout from this because we know that Russia is actually the third a country on the list of the U.S. when it imports oil. Of course, we're looking at Europe also suffering from this. The price of oil hasn't led. There was inflation, and now this is adding to the rise of inflation, which is at record levels, not only in the U.S., but also in Europe. So these shock waves, is it sustainable for the U.S. and for Europe, let alone the rest of the world? For how long you think that this course can continue?
For Europe, there will be a serious problem very soon because the shortages, not only in energy supply, will hamper the small economic restart after the pandemic. So the situation will be, from a socioeconomic point of view, extremely tense, if not dangerous. And we will see it in the coming 3 months or so, because data that are coming in that basically, with the level of prices of today, most people will have just to either not hit themselves or stop their activities. So this is a situation that will backslash on Europe, and the awkward attempt to make the deal so that Iran could trade its oil because of the nuclear agreement is apparently in jeopardy at the moment, because the Americans have been pushing to a level that finally even the export of enriched uranium to Russia is not possible. So this is a sort of a cage 22 situation. Europe will have to rethink this aggressive sanctioning policy that has adopted.
Well, I'm not too sure if Europe is rethinking that, John Ross, when you're looking at, for example, how European gas prices are trading at what MarketWatch said is equivalent of over $500 per barrel. You're in London. This is what's amazing, where bills are set, electric bills, energy bills are set to hit £3,000 this year. That means 40 million UK citizens are heading for fuel poverty. So when our guest Paolo Raffone talks about Europe needs to think this through, well, people are going to, they don't have enough money to heat their homes. And we know in the UK, people die as a result of not being able to afford their electric bills or their gas or energy bills. Is this something the UK is taking into consideration?
No, but I think it will result in the fall of a large number of European governments, West European governments, because they've embarked upon a policy which is deeply damaging to their population. And in the contrast in Russia is that people will rally behind the government, because you don't understand Russian history. Russia, to defeat Hitler, suffered 27 million people dead. Undoubtedly, the Russian population will suffer as a result of the sanctions. But they're not, you know, it's nothing. I won't say it's trivial, but it's nothing compared to what Russia has been through in its history. Therefore, they will rally behind what the government is doing. Whereas in Western Europe, I would say, because of the result of the inflation, a large number of Western European governments will fall. And as I said, the Biden administration has committed suicide.
Okay. It's interesting. Paolo Raffone, what we're trying to do here is look at the Russian perspective and then look at the perspective from the Europeans and the U.S. And maybe we could put the rest of the world somewhat in that, minus, obviously, Russia's allies. It seems that the perspective from the European and the U.S. side is putting aside the, the interests of the people. And they're solely going after Putin. They want to bring Putin to its knees. The desire seems to be portrayed as such. Do you think that motivation is costing the Europeans and even the U.S. the well-being of their own citizens as a result of their sanctions regime?
Definitely it is, and it should be understood. So we are trying to understand who does what and why. So from the U.S. perspective, the challenge through military means that Russia has made is intolerable, for the fact that it is putting an end to the hegemony that the United States have had since the end of Second World War in Europe, in the way that we have seen unfolded, especially in the past two or three decades. So this is something that for the United States sent all the strategists ballistic. And so they have now put in place this incredibly nonsensical aggression to a single person, which is Putin, and trying to unite the ranks in the West against this enemy that has been identified. Well, this is working in the short time now, but we have to see already in the medium time what will happen. And I doubt that democratic governments, which are inelastic to restrictions and shortages, will support this kind of policy.
Okay. Let's move on to another aspect of this, if we can, John Ross, and talk about the dollar. in which the U.S. has been very fond of using it in many different ways, and one in its foreign policy by weaponizing the effect and the use of the dollar. It's one of the tools in the U.S.'s toolbox. It seems to think that it could do that when it comes to Russia, through the sanctions policy especially. But many analysts are concluding that this may backfire, that the dollar is going to get threatened. One way that it's going to get threatened, and I'd like to ask from you, is how Russia has de-dollarized its economy for quite some time. And you add to that, for example, a major ally like China, who's been doing the same, not to mention Iran, who is also on that path. Do you think the dollar will be threatened as a result of the Ukrainian conflict and how it's progressing in that direction more and more?
Well, the position of the dollar will be weakened, but the dollar remains one of the strongest aspects of the United States. I do not anticipate that the dollar will collapse as the main means of international payment in the coming period, and therefore this will create problems for Russia. Russia and China and Iran and other countries have definitely been attempting to de-dollarize, but this is a very difficult process which will take maybe 10 or 20 years. So my estimate would be that the sanctions, including the dollar, will impose pain on the Russian population. I don't want to pretend that they won't, but the Russian population, because they can see that they're defending their country, will be prepared to withstand this pain much more than the governments in the United States or Western Europe are capable of withstanding that pain. So I would like to say that the dollar will disappear, you know, as an international currency, you know, in the next 5 years, but I don't honestly believe it.
Well, this one particular viewer seems to think otherwise, Paolo Raffone, and I'm going to read off what he has posted. The decision to push almost 3 billion people from Russia, India, and China into trading with each other in currencies other than the dollar will go down as one of the most short-sighted and self-destructive policies in U.S. history. Do you agree?
To a certain extent, yes. It is evident that the building of this wall of sanctions and threats of military interventions, let's also think to Taiwan, it's something that is strengthening the links between all the rest of the world out of the West. So this is also something that we have seen, despite the majority vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations, the declarations of the single governments before the vote, they were quite interesting. I mean, they condemned the use of force, of course, because we are in the UN and it is the charter demanding it. But at the same time, there were a lot of nuances. So continuing this aggressive approach may risk to shift the majority of people who voted in the UN towards a new majority, which says we have enough of this aggressiveness of the United States, its dollar, and its guns. So this may happen. And it is a gamble. We have to see what will be the evolution in the next days or weeks of the current warfare in Europe.
Okay. Well, since I'm looking at the clock, we really don't have that much time here. You've mentioned, John Ross, a number of times Russia's history here. And I'd like to also point out how the Russian President Vladimir Putin on many occasions has said that these nationalists or far-right Nazis, as he's called them, are using people as human shields. The history check that you gave us, the statements from Vladimir Putin, none of this is truly reflected in the media. Why is it that side, the Russian side, is being neglected, at least to show, and I'm not promoting the civilian casualties caused as a result of this war, nor promoting war. Why isn't that side being, or that narrative at least, being covered in the way that it should?
Well, because the West has been carried on for 30 years a policy of aggression against Russia, that's the United States. The United States pretended that its only opposition to Russia was over communism, but once communism collapsed in 1991, the United States continued its aggression against Russia. So that shows that what the US policy was a total lie. So if you have 30 years of aggression against Russia, the truth of the situation is going to be concealed at the present time. And that's exactly what's happening.
30 seconds, Paolo Raffone. The threat of a third world war, nuclear proliferation, economic recessions possibly,